First of all, thank you all for thank you for inviting me. It's really nice to be here. This is my first time at Perimeter, so it's really really nice place. And thank you also all for coming. I understand you've been having a lot of seminars recently, so I appreciate it. Anyway, so I'm going to be talking about quantum phase transitions from ADS2 beyond the Landau paradigm. So basically, I'm just going to be discussing a particular kind of quantum phase transition that arises in certain models of gauge gravity duality. It's rather interesting. It's different from those that we're used to, and I'll explain some of its features and try to explain as much as I can about the physics that causes it. Okay, so this is in so some of this work is in a paper that appeared a while ago, and some of it is going to come out soon. And it's in collaboration with my advisor at MIT, Hong Liu, a student, Mark Meze, and Chimiao Sit, who's a condensed matter theorist at Rice. Okay, so here we go. So before plunging into this, let's just talk a little bit about phase transitions in general. Okay, so what is a phase transition? A continuous phase transition. So imagine you have some sort of spin system. Okay, you have a bunch of spins, and imagine it's at high temperature, so they're very disordered. Okay, we're going to start lowering the temperature. If you want to describe the phase transition, it's often useful to do so in a continuum field theory. Close to the phase transition, continuum quantum field theory is a good way to do it. And imagine finding some sort of coarse-grained order parameter. The potential for that order parameter will look something like this in the disordered phase. Okay, very roughly, the order parameter will sit at zero, and that's roughly because it's disordered. There's no structure in this. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if we're at a very low temperature, you could imagine some interaction or something wants the spins to align. So this is the energetically feasible state, you know. And in that case, the potential for the order parameter will look like this. It'll look like a Higgs potential. It's developed a double well, and the vacuum will be one of these guys. Okay, it's all really basic stuff. That means that in the middle, between the two of them, at some critical temperature, there's some scale invariant part where fluctuations on all length scales are equally important. And in the continuum description, that sort of just means that there's a, you know, you can think of it as being there's a massless field at the critical point. Okay? The correlation length diverges, there's a massless field. And so that's what happens at criticality. There are long-range correlations that are described well by continuum quantum field theory. So this is just this is called the Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson paradigm. It's the basic understanding of continuous phase transitions. Okay. So one question you can ask, though, is what other things can happen? Are there phase transitions that don't fit easily into this paradigm? So I'm going to describe one such phase transition today. Okay. So here's an outline of my talk. There'll be an introduction where I'll set things up. I will discuss holographic phase transitions in general, both at finite temperature and then at zero temperature. I'll discuss the new types of critical phenomena that appear at this transition I'll be telling you about. I'll describe the condensed phase a little bit, and then I'll conclude with some future directions. Okay. So holography gives us a lot of new tools for studying field theories. In particular, we can study field theories at strong coupling very easily. Okay. So let's think about the minimal ingredients that we need to have a phase transition in holography. So let's study a really, really simple model. Okay, imagine having an electric charge, okay, a U1, a conserved U1 current, J. This is dual to a bulk U1 gauge field, A. And imagine also having an order parameter that I'll eventually condense in the field theory, O. This is dual to some bulk scalar field, phi. Okay. I'll be working throughout. Nothing that I say will really depend too much on the dimensions or anything like that, but I'll be working in ADS4 for concreteness. This is dual to a 2 plus 1 dimensional boundary theory. Okay. And now we need to make some choices. Since we have a scalar, we need to make some choices about the mass and the charge and all these things. So let me just assume that the potential of the scalar looks like this. Okay. And for now, let me also just remain agnostic about the scalar charge and the mass. I'll specify soon what conditions I want them to satisfy. Okay, so this is a very simple model. All right, there's also an Einstein-Hilbert term in the action and an F-squared term for the gauge field. Okay, so this is a very, very simple model, but it's one that has a lot of very rich physics, actually, as I'll now show. Okay, so what can we do with this model? So first of all, I want to state where something interesting will happen. Okay. The vacuums of most of these conformal field theories are, you know, they're not tremendously interesting. Everything, all the correlators are fixed by scale invariants. So all the two-point functions, rather. So to create something interesting, I'm going to study a finite density state, okay? A state with a finite density of electric charge. So how do I do that? I turn on a chemical potential mu for this U1 current, J, Okay, and I'm also still trying to find a temperature. What this means is, in the gravity dual, I'm studying a particular kind of charged black hole. There is the Nordstrom ADS-4 background. So there's some metric. The key point here is that the gauge field at infinity goes to a constant, which is the value of this chemical potential. And that means there is an electric field in this geometry. There's an electric field. And the flux of the electric field is basically the charge density. And there's a very, very special property of this geometry. At T equals to 0, at 0 temperature, the near horizon geometry factorizes into ADS2 times R2. Okay, now why does this happen? It's actually very simple to understand why this sort of has to happen in this model. There's an electric field that goes through the geometry. Okay, now we're in an asymptotically ADS background, so there's a negative cosmological constant that sort of wants to make all the directions shrink, space and time both. But now, if you have an electric field through here, then the electric field flux, it pokes through this R2, and Gauss's law tells you the electric flux is constant. So that means that the R2 actually cannot shrink. The R2 must become a finite size as you go into the interior of the geometry over here. Okay? On the other hand, we're still in a negative cosmological constant background, and that means the curvature must go somewhere. It has to come from someplace, and that means it has to come from this ADS2. Okay? So the existence of this ADS2 is sort of a generic feature of this simplest finite density background. All right. And this ADS2 will be very important. So let me just summarize. Asymptotically in the UV, it's an ADS4. In the infrared, it's an ADS2 times R2. And you can view this even as a sort of RG flow from the UV down to this IR. Okay. Are there any questions about this finite density state? Okay. Good. All right, so this ADS2 will be very important. What does it mean? So ADS2 has extra symmetries. And what that means is that at finite density, there's an emergent conformal symmetry in the infrared. This conformal symmetry only acts on the time direction, because only the time and the radial direction are involved in this. So this ADS2 is very useful for all kinds of things. In particular, it's proven very useful for understanding these holographic non-Fermi liquids that were studied by my collaborators and me a while back. And you can really see that it determines almost all of the interesting low-frequency behavior of the system. So these are fermions. In this talk, I'll be studying scalars. And I'll show that, again, it causes lots of very interesting behavior. Okay. So what do I mean by this? Well, all operators in the IR-CFT have dimensions under this emergent conformal symmetry. So for example, take a charge scalar. Okay. This charge scalar will have a dimension in this ADS2 region. And you find that dimension just by using the ordinary rules from ADS-CFT, except applied to the ADS2 region. So there's an effective mass in the ADS2. That mass is different from the UV mass. Basically, first of all, because the curvature scale is different, so the way that it affects the mass plays with the curvature is different in the ADS2 region. But also because there could be other fields that are active. So for example, if the scalar is charged, there's a background gauge field in the ADS2 region that contributes with a negative sign, giving a dimension that is shifted from just the mass contribution with a minus q squared here. All right? So now, if you stare at this formula, you realize that if you make q sufficiently large, okay, or m sufficiently small, this can go imaginary, all right? Even though in the UV, it was still real. So the ADS4 dimension is completely fine, but the ADS2 dimension is imaginary, all right? So that seems very bad, having an imaginary conformal dimension. And what that really means is that the system is unstable, okay? The system is unstable, and if we're at zero temperature, when this ADS2 really exists, the scalar will necessarily condense. So this is the mechanism that drives the holographic superconductor, which you guys have probably heard of, which has been extensively first introduced by Gubser, Hartnell, Herzog, and Horowitz, and it's been studied by lots of people since then. And this is basically why it happens. At zero temperature, the system is unstable. You can stabilize it at a finite temperature, because when you increase the temperature, on physical grounds, you expect to be able to stabilize these condensates. And from this gravity point of view, at finite temperature, the ADS2 is removed, it's destroyed, and this argument no longer quite goes through. So if you raise the temperature high enough, you can stabilize the system. Okay. Now, something that's not immediately obvious without plugging in numbers is that even if you're at Q equals to 0, okay, no Q here, there is a finite range of mass for which the scalar can satisfy the ADS4 BF bound, but still violate the ADS2 BF bound. Okay? So you can even condense a neutral order parameter in this system. For simplicity, I'm going to focus on this case, even though nothing that I, just because the some numerics is simpler in, or simpler in this case, but when I discuss the phase transition, it will not depend on this detail. Okay. So let's warm up, okay? Let's study some physics at finite temperature first. Okay? I just claimed that you could find a condensed phase and it should be destroyed at finite temperature. So let's do this. So let's take a neutral scalar with a small mass, okay, small enough to violate the ADS2 BF bound, and let's search numerically for a condensed phase solution at various temperatures. So in the bulk, what I'm doing is I'm just solving the scalar wave equation. All right? And this neutral case is very simple, basically because lambda, I should have explained what lambda is, just the parameter I have out front of the scalar action. If I take it to infinity, I can neglect back reaction, and this makes life simpler. But again, nothing I'm saying is qualitatively changed if you include back reaction. So at finite temperature, the horizon regularity fully determines the solution. So if I demand that the scalar be regular at the black hole horizon, I can just immediately integrate outwards, okay? So I integrate outwards, I take my regular solution and move it out. I find at infinity, okay, there is a, I can look at these two things, there's a big falloff and a small falloff. In ADS CFT, the coefficient of the big falloff is the source, and the coefficient of the small falloff is the VEV. So I find a one parameter family of solutions, I integrate it outwards, and I can generate a curve telling us how the system responds to arbitrary sources. So let me do this. Numerically, I find something like this. Here, A should really be H, and B should be the VEV. But you can see that it's not hard to generate these curves. And what you find is something very simple. For example, suppose I want the normalizable solution. So zero source, but non-zero VEV. There's one right here, right? Because this A is the source. This is the source. So over here, I have zero source, but non-zero VEV. And this is the condensed phase solution that I told you should exist. Okay? So this is just as we expect. All right. So now, let me try increasing the temperature. Okay?
Can you go back for a moment? Did you study, you also had one with zero bed.
That's right, yeah.
Would we see an unstable mode there?
If you're in the other quantization, right? So this guy here has, exactly, it has zero... it has zero VEV and non-zero source, right? So from the point of view of this this system, it's just an interesting fact that I turn the source to this thing and the response vanishes. But also, in this range of masses, there's an alternative quantization where the roles of the source and the VEV are switched. And so this should really be interpreted as a bound state in that quantization.
Okay. I was more focused on the origin, though.
Oh, the origin. Sorry. Okay.
So that's sort of the unstable point at the top of the...
Yeah, that's the, if you think of this as the unstable point at the top
and
of the potential.
Yeah.
You'd see an unstable mode there. That's right. If you, let's see.
Oh, is that the mode that you, this complex exponent?
It's related to that, but we're at finite temperature, so it's related to that, though. The reason why it exists, the reason why it must exist at arbitrarily zero temperature is basically because of that complex exponent. But since we're at finite temperature, if you did the calculation, what you'd see is, if you say you did a finite omega calculation about this point, there'd be a pole in the upper half plane, indicating instability. And you can also show thermodynamically that this has lower free energy than this. So all these things are related. Yeah. Okay, sorry, I thought you were talking about this thing. Yeah. Okay, good?
If you choose a range of masses such that there is no alternative quantization,
yeah.
Is the point on the A-axis
what is this?
Crossing that axis?
Let's see. So that depends on global details of the potential. I'm not sure off the top of my head. I'm not actually sure. Yeah. It's a good question. Yeah, I think you need to do numerics to figure that out. And I think we didn't probe the full range of masses. Yeah. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. So let's study what happens at finite temperature now. Okay. So let me remind everybody what the susceptibility is. Suppose I'm in a region that is well described by linear response. Okay. So I have, say, an applied field and a VEV. Okay. The susceptibility tells me how the VEV responds to the source. Okay, O is chi times h. Chi is just the slope of this curve here. Okay, so this is good if I'm studying things close to the vacuum there. Okay. So these are cartoon pictures, okay, but they illustrate what happens in the actual system if you do the numerics. So let's study several phases. Okay, suppose I'm at very high temperature. Then the curve looks something like this. you can see that there are no non-trivial states with zero source. All right? And the susceptibility is finite. What that means is if you apply a field, you will get a response, but it's a finite response. Okay? Just as you expect for a disordered system. Now let's start decreasing the temperature. All right? Eventually, I get to a critical temperature, okay, TC. At the critical point, the susceptibility diverges, okay, linearly in the temperature. You can sort of see that this had to happen because if you keep going further still, you get to this condensed phase that I drew for you earlier, and here the curve looks like this. It seems kind of obvious that in between the condensed phase and the normal phase, there must be some point where the susceptibility diverges, right? That just must happen based on continuity of curves, okay? So these are cartoon pictures, but they are, in fact, exactly what happens if you do the numerics. And they're also precisely the predictions of mean field Landau theory, all right? Now, this isn't really surprising. We're solving classical equations of motion that are very smooth, okay? We're integrating from a horizon up to infinity. It's all very smooth. And you don't really expect anything tremendously interesting to happen here, all right? So this is due to the fact that in the dual theory, we're studying things in the large n limit, and normally in the large n limit, you expect to find mean field transitions. Okay? So just remember this fact. In this finite temperature transition, the susceptibility diverges as we approach the transition, and it's very standard transition everywhere. It's just like the pictures I drew at the very beginning. Okay, fine. Now, okay, so that really about wraps up the finite temperature transition. Okay, so we're all warmed up. So now I'd like to talk about a quantum phase transition instead. This will turn out to be much more interesting. So the question is, can we tune the critical temperature to zero somehow? If we can, then at zero temperature, we'll have a quantum phase transition that's driven not by temperature, but by quantum effects in some way, at least in the dual theory. So recall that the IR dimension of my operator is this thing. The instability only exists if nu is imaginary. Thus, if I take this guy and start increasing it, eventually I should go through nu goes to zero. As I get closer and closer to nu is zero, the instability is becoming weaker and weaker, and I should need less and less of a temperature to fix it. And thus, as I get to nu equals zero, the critical temperature should go all the way to zero, and I should have a quantum phase transition. Okay? An alternative way to say this is just sit at t equals zero and tune this guy. When it's positive, there's no instability. When it's negative, there is one. So at that point, there's a quantum phase transition. Okay? Good. So what I want to do is then, I want to tune the IR dimension of my operator. All right. So this seems kind of strange, right? How do you tune a dimension? How can I do this? Okay. So here's the crudest way to do it. Set the charge to zero, take the mass, and tune it by hand. Okay? This is a well-posed gravity problem. And for simplicity, for most of our numerics, this is actually how we did it. But you might say this is, okay, this is a gravity problem, but it's not really dual to anything obvious. In the dual theory, you cannot just tune the dimension of an operator by hand. Okay, so something more sophisticated you can do, which is keep Q non-zero, but turn on a magnetic field on the boundary. Okay? That magnetic field on the boundary changes my black hole into a dionic black hole with both electric and magnetic charge. It still has an ADS2 factor, but the scaling dimensions in that ADS2 factor are different. If you go through a computation, you can derive this formula for the scaling dimension. This is a mess, but the point is that for most values of the mass and the charge, there's a critical B field above which this is real and below which this is imaginary. So you should imagine, I take a holographic superconductor, I turn on a magnetic field, if I tune it large enough, it destroys the order. Okay? This is exactly as you expect. So this is a lot less crude than that example. You can think that are less crude still. You can study the D3, D5 system, okay? This was studied by these guys, Jensen, Carson, and Thompson. It has, the D3, D5 system has an unstable mode corresponding to a chiral condensate. If you go through the work, you find that the equation of motion is actually the same as this neutral case with a mass squared that depends on the magnetic field in that system. Okay, so it's a little bit different. The order parameter has no charge, but you still have a magnetic field you can tune to tune the IR dimension. So there are various ways to tune this IR dimension. And the universality class of the transition doesn't depend on what knob you actually use. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to parameterize this with some coupling G. Okay? At GC, we have a transition. For G less than GC, the scalar violates the ADS2 BF bound, and there's an instability. Okay. So I will now study what happens as I violate this bound. Okay. Are there any questions at this point? Okay. Good. All right. So here's basically what you expect to happen. For G less than GC, you need a finite temperature to stabilize it. At G equals to GC, there's a quantum phase transition. And my question is just, what is the nature of this quantum critical point? And you know, what happens if you violate the ADS2BF bound? So this is a really simple question, really. It's sort of the analog of in flat space taking a potential and turning it into a double well potential, except I'm doing it in an ADS2 geometry. Okay. So let's approach the critical point from below. Okay. The physics slightly below the ADS2 BF bound is an example of the annihilation of two conformal fixed points. This was studied in some detail by these guys, Kaplan, Lison, and Stefanov, in a paper called Conformality Lost that is very nice. I recommend it. So first of all, let me explain what I mean by annihilation of two conformal fixed points. There's a really easy way to see this. You know that in ADS CFT, there are two dimensions for an operator. For given if it's a sufficiently small mass, there are two dimensions for an operator. There's two ways to quantize the theory. You can do it in standard quantization, which corresponds to taking a plus sign here, or alternative quantization, which has a minus sign here. It's clear that as this guy goes to zero, so as I cross the ADS2 BF bound, these two quantizations coincide. So in some sense, there used to be two conformal fixed points. They're coming together. And past the BF bound, it turns out there are actually no conformal fixed points. So we have lost conformality. And what happens is that you no longer have a conformal phase, so a scale is generated. That IR scale is related to some UV scale in this way. Okay? There's an exponential and this pi square root business here. Okay? It's rather strange. And this peculiar exponential behavior has been observed before. It's characteristic of the Berezinski-Kostelitz-Tauless transition, which is a totally different phase transition that involves vortex physics in two dimensions. But the physics of that is not related in any obvious way to the physics in our system, but I'll be calling this BKT scaling from now on. Okay? So this is BKT scaling. And this scale controls all the physics near the transition, okay? The critical temperature, the VEV, etc. So let's understand how this works in our setup. Okay? So let's understand the IR scale geometrically. All right. So let me take my ADS2 and put coordinates on it like this. Okay? These are normal Poincaré coordinates. As z goes to infinity, we have the infrared. As z goes to zero, we're in the ultraviolet. The ultraviolet of the ADS2, of course, is not the full ultraviolet of the theory. This eventually merges onto an asymptotic ADS4 geometry this way. Now, let me go below the critical temperature and study the scalar wave equation on this background. Okay. The equation looks like this. And this is a famous quantum mechanics problem. Okay. This looks like a Schrodinger equation where the energy is omega squared and the potential is 1 over z squared. And this is a very famous problem. It's the 1 over z squared potential. And if g is less than gc, okay, when this thing goes below 0, this problem has infinitely many negative energy bound states. Okay, this is a classic result from the 50s. But what that means is negative energy means that omega is imaginary. And this is the scalar instability I told you about. Okay, so I claim that if you violate the BF bound, you should have instability. This is how you can see it. But this statement is only true if z can go over the whole half line. Okay? Z is an unbounded number here. On the other hand, in our problem, that's not the case, right? It doesn't go over the whole half line. There's a UV cutoff, at least, in the UV, where the ADS4 region begins. And imagine also that we put an IR cutoff. All right? This will help stabilize the spectrum, because if you have z bounded, then there must be a ground state that has a certain energy. All right? And if you make these smaller and smaller, you expect from general principles to push the ground state energy up. And eventually, it'll become positive, and I'll lose the instability. So the question I'm asking is this. Let me search for a system, for a ground state that has precisely zero energy. Okay? That should fix a relation between ZIR and ZUV. Now, if the ground state has zero energy, then all the excited modes must have higher energy. And so what that means is I will have found the minimum distance between these two for which the instability can be stabilized. All right? So I'll find some relation between these two guys. So let's do that calculation. Let me assume for simplicity that there's Dirichlet boundary conditions on both ends. And I'm looking for a zero energy ground state. So let me set the energy to zero. So threshold solutions. Now I solve that wave equation, and I get a solution that looks like this. Okay? Now, this is an omega equals to zero solution, but I want this also to be the ground state of the system, which means that it should oscillate only once from here to there. Okay? If that happens, it will have no nodes, and it will be the ground state and the lowest energy state. But you can see that to satisfy these boundary conditions now, there's a relation between these two. All right? This is the relation. And what that means is you need at least this distance between these two, but this is precisely that exponential hierarchy of scales that I told you about, okay? Because Z, IR, and ZUV in ADS CFT, radiuses represent energy scales, and thus this is telling you that there's an exponential hierarchy between these two energy scales. So that was that relation that I described to you earlier, that I put on the board earlier. And you can derive this in many ways. You can also, like for example, in that conformality loss paper, they derived this studying RG flows. In generality, this is just a simple gravity derivation of this. Okay? But the point is, this is the scale that is generated, and this scale controls all of the physics near the transition. Okay? Now. Okay. So in our system, what provides this scale? Well, one way is via a finite temperature. Okay? So let me try replacing the ADS2 with an ADS2 black hole. Then the horizon that appears cuts off the geometry in precisely this way by introducing some ZIR, some infrared cutoff. And thus, what I've actually done is a derivation of the critical temperature of this system close to this critical point. Okay? So let me... All right, I'll draw it here. Let me draw a picture of the phase diagram that I had. Let me use one of those. Good idea. Okay. So basically, I had some critical point here. I claimed that the critical temperature should come to zero here. What I've just derived is a formula for how the critical temperature goes to zero at this point here. It goes to zero very, 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 very smoothly. Every single derivative vanishes. Okay? And if T is greater than the critical temperature, there is no instability in this system. This is what stabilizes it. Okay? Good? On the other hand, another way is that if the temperature is zero, then I know the scalar will condense. What that means is that in the deep infrared, the scalar will develop some non-zero VEV, and then non-linearities get into the game, and they play an important role. I'll discuss this in more detail later, but basically what happens at the end of the day is that the size of the VEV at zero temperature is also determined by this scalar. All right? And I'll come back to this in a little bit. Okay. So basically, this scale controls everything in the transition. Are there any questions at this point? Okay. All right, so thus, what we have is a BKT-generated energy scale in time and a novel quantum critical point. Okay? To my knowledge, this is a new type of quantum critical point where you only have a dynamically generated scale in time and the spatial directions are acting differently. So the natural question to ask when you have a new critical point now is, what is the critical behavior close to that point? All right? You expect that as you approach this point, new gapless modes should emerge. All right? And the question is just, what happens? What do they look like? What is their dispersion? What do they behave like? All right? So it's a little bit intricate. So let me draw this picture first to illustrate what happens. Then I'll talk about different areas of it. So here's the coupling, and there's, say, an energy scale, like omega or the temperature. All right? I already drew this line here that tells you about this critical temperature line. At temperatures less than that, the system is in a condensed phase. Okay? There's a blue region here in the phase diagram that's accessible if you're at finite frequency or temperature. In this region, it takes a very sort of universal form where it does not depend on this G, this coupling, or even really on the momentum. So I'll explain this in a second. Okay? And around here, it's different, and there's a crossover between these two regions. Okay? So, okay, let's do this. All right, so first of all, let me have a little interlude where I discuss how you actually do finite frequency response at low temperatures. So you want to compute the retarded correlator for this operator O. How do we do this? Well, you impose infalling boundary conditions at the black hole horizon. This is told to us by Son and Sternetz. Then things are a bit hard at zero temperature, though. The expansion, you really want to expand the small, you want to find analytic formulas for the small frequency behavior. But this is kind of subtle if there's an ADS2 region, because the ADS2 region introduces non-analyticities in the frequency. So to do this correctly, what you do is you find an exact solution in the ADS2, and then you match that solution onto a UV solution that takes you from the ADS2 region up to here. The way to do this was developed by my collaborators at MIT, and you extract the actual answer at the boundary. So you then expand this thing near the boundary. You have these two falloffs in the ADS4 region, and the retarded Green's function is just the ratio of these two falloffs. So the point is that the ADS2 region really contributes almost all of the interesting behavior. The UV region does not really know about the phase transition. All right? And I'll explain in more detail as I go along how this works out in the correlation functions. Okay, good. So now let's do this. So first, let's calculate the susceptibility. All right? So remember, in a disordered phase, it looks something like this. We expect something to happen as I cross through to the disordered. In a disordered phase, it looks like this. I expect something interesting to happen as I cross through to the ordered phase, as I cross through the quantum phase transition. So if you go through the calculation that I just described, what you find is something very strange. Let's start on the ordered side and move towards the critical point. The susceptibility takes the following form. Okay, here alpha, alpha tilde, beta, and beta tilde are just constants from solving the UV wave equation. So they're really just pure numbers. Okay, I have formulas for them. This is like, you know, these three are positive, that one's negative. They're just pure numbers. And the strange thing is, as you approach the critical point, it does not diverge, unlike the transition I talked about earlier. I mean, something does happen. It sort of bifurcates in that this thing becomes imaginary, and you know something interesting must happen. But it does not diverge as you approach the critical point. Okay, this is very different from what you expect in a normal phase transition. It bifurcates. It does not diverge. All right? So, okay. So the susceptibility stays constant as I approach the critical point. All right. So you might ask how this can be possible, given that the nonlinear response must develop bound states. And I'll explain how that can happen in a second. Okay. So now let's imagine turning on a finite k. Okay. So by the way, let me just illustrate what region I'm looking at in the phase diagram. So there's some interesting thing happening here. I'm right now at omega equals to 0, and I'm approaching along this line right here. Okay, so omega and temperature are 0, and I'm approaching along the critical line right here. Okay. If I turn on a finite momentum, then this contributes to the ADS2 mass. And what that means is the dimension of the operator in the IR is shifted by this k squared. We can understand why a k squared appears there just from thinking that from the two-dimensional point of view, any momentum along the R2 just looks, you know, it contributes to the mass in some way. It's sort of like doing a kk reduction along the R2. Okay? So this, however, pushes us away from the critical point. All right? Because now this will no longer go imaginary. And in the complex k plane, you find branch cuts starting at these two places, right? This just comes from the square root structure. What you can do is you can use these branch cuts to do a Fourier transform over k. And what you find is a correlation length, okay, that diverges as this goes to 0 in a very mean field sort of way. So in the ordinary mean field scaling. Even though I explained the critical temperature and all that was not mean field scaling at all. The reason why this happens is because these spatial directions along the R2 do not take part in this IRCFT. Okay, the IRCFT in the ADS2 direction provides all the interesting non-trivial structure, but the spatial part basically doesn't know about that. So the spatial part behaves like an ordinary mean field transition. Okay, but you can only see that spatial, this sort of thing, if you're precisely at omega equals to 0 as you approach the transition. Okay, at any finite omega, you will eventually, or temperature, you'll eventually come here into this region, which I'll discuss now. Okay? Okay, so now let's turn on a finite omega or temperature. Again, you go through the matching calculation, and what you find is in the blue region, the response takes this form. Okay, there's a ratio of logarithms. But what's interesting is that in this region, the system does not know about, first of all, the, you know, in this region, everywhere it takes exactly this form, where the system doesn't know about g minus gc, so how far you are from the critical point, or in fact even about k. Okay? All the momentum dependence in this formula is very, very subleading. Okay? It slightly renormalizes the values of beta and alpha, which are UV things, and it slightly renormalizes the value of this constant here. It doesn't significantly change the structure, which is interesting because you don't expect, generally, that near a critical point, spatial correlations will play no role at all, which is what I'm telling you happens if you're at finite omega or temperature. Okay? And this behavior holds over an exponentially large range of frequencies. All right? So the crossover between this region and the earlier region, basically you need logarithm of omega to be much, much smaller than this thing. Okay? And this is an exponentially large hierarchy, basically. Okay? So if you actually plot the curve that you get, demanding that this be small, then you get some separation line that looks like this. All right? So again, this is a sort of exponential hierarchy that's generated from this BKT transition. Okay. Oh, wait, here, sorry. It's really the UV scale, the chemical potential. Yeah, I should have put that in there. So it's this omega B and omega A are what are the effective scales for this thing. And they're related. You can derive formulas for them. But basically, they're the chemical potential times constants that come from solving the UV wave equation that sort of renormalize the chemical potential as you move down. Okay? All right. So this is basically the critical behavior at finite frequency. Okay? So this is the limit that you can do from linear response. All right? So next, I'm going to sit at zero temperature and cross through to the condensed phase to explain what happens there. Are there any questions about the linear response? Okay. Now, what on the other hand, what if G is less than GC? Okay, so we are now in the condensed phase here. So let's sit at zero temperature and actually just move straight through the transition. Okay? Now, we know that if we're at zero temperature, we must be in a condensed phase. And so the deep infrared will depend on details of the nonlinearities. So it seems that we need to do numerics for sure, right? We can't really, it seems we need to do something numerical to get the answer. But actually, you can do a lot analytically. So let me explain how. Split the space-time into three regions, okay? So in the UV, we have ADS4, no matter what. There should be a nonlinear region. In the deep infrared, basically the scalar will be sitting at the bottom of its potential. It'll be very nonlinear. But if you're close to the critical point, though, the quantum critical point, you expect that over a large range of radiuses, the scalar should be very, very small, because on the other side of the critical point, it's actually zero. So you expect that there should be a region here, okay, where it looks, basically the scalar is very, very small, so it looks a lot like a linear scalar propagating on that ADS2 background, okay? So what do you expect the scalar to do then? Well, it starts out being very, very nonlinear, so it's very big and nonlinear here. Now it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. Eventually it reaches this point here where you can treat it as a scalar as a linear scalar propagating on ADS2, but with a mass that violates the BF bound. Since it violates the BF bound, it oscillates, and so it should oscillate some number of times here. And then eventually, by now though, it's small, okay, and it continues to get smaller and smaller as I go this way. So from here on in, basically, I can treat it like a linear problem. So what I want to do is I want to isolate all the nonlinearities here, and then close to the critical point, I want to match that onto a linear problem and try to do this analytically. It turns out that close to the transition, you can actually do this. Up to one parameter you have to find, and you have to find numerically, you can determine an analytic formula for this response curve, okay, for the nonlinear response curve. So the nonlinear analog of this guy. Now, what we expect it to do, we expect it to have some sort of oscillatory character, and also we expect it to explain how the susceptibility can remain finite as we cross the transition. Okay? So what actually happens? Well, if I'm at G greater than GC, I'm in a disordered phase, and so basically the response curve just looks like this, close to the origin. What happens as I cross through the critical point is that this thing sort of explodes, okay? It explodes into a spiral that looks like this. And what happens to this spiral is that it actually goes on it actually goes on forever. Okay? So above the critical point in this region, Iceland looks like this. The instant I cross the critical point, okay, at large values it looks the same, but it develops a spiral that goes around and around and around and around and around, and it never stops. It keeps going around and around and around all the way to the bottom. Okay, so that thing there is using actual, it's not numerical, it's using the analytic formula that we have. It goes around and around all the way to the bottom. Basically, this is how this can reconcile these two things. The susceptibility being finite can only happen basically because this explosion is sort of unique. Okay? So what you can do now is you can realize that this is the H line. This is O. There is an infinite number of normalizable states corresponding to each intersection of this spiral with this line. Sorry, they're actually here. With this line, H equals 0. Okay? There's an infinite number of states. We call them Efimov states because the spacing of these states, you can show, is exponential. With the hierarchy between them generated by that BKT scale that I talked about, this exponential of minus pi over root gc minus g. And you can furthermore, you can show that as you cross the transition, the outermost state has a scaling that is given precisely by this. Okay? So this is the location of the outermost Efimov state. And this outermost state turns out to be the one that's thermodynamically preferred. So what happens is a new state appears, but it appears in this exponential way, and appears with together with the appearance of infinitely many other states that go all the way down. Okay? So this is how a susceptibility can be finite approaching the transition, yet still give you a bound state as you cross. Okay. So are there any questions? Okay, so let me just describe some more features of the spiral. The states are exponentially spaced. You can imagine there's some sort of discrete scale invariance that's broken eventually by the ultraviolet. And like I said, the outermost state is the one that is thermodynamically stable. Okay, it has this scaling that I mentioned earlier. And you can show that analytically. At any finite temperature, you sort of expect this bizarre structure to go away. And indeed, what you find is that at any finite temperature, instead of going around an infinite number of times, what happens is that it goes around a bunch of times, and then finally it goes straight down to the horizon. And you get, straight down to the origin. And you get a normal linear response curve there. At zero temperature, it never stops spiraling. And that happens, like, linear response is never good, basically. There's never a regime where you can do that. And that's because in the far interior, the scalar is sitting at the bottom of its potential. And nonlinearities are always important if you go sufficiently far in. That manifests itself in this response curve with this spiral that keeps going down and down forever. But at finite temperature, it just looks like close enough to the origin, it really looks like an ordinary sort of phase transition again. And finally, as we approach the critical point from the other side, what you can show analytically is that the spiral gets squished more and more and more. Like you can look at this, and the spiral becomes squished more and more and more until eventually it's just squished into a straight line that then smoothly matches onto this linear response straight line. And remember, there had to be because there's a finite susceptibility as we approach that point. Okay. So this is the structure of the condensed phase in this model. Any questions?
Is there anything similar observed in the BKT transition?
I think formally the BKT transition, you mean the real BKT transition, is that right? I think formally, I think in the standard one, no, I don't think so. I think there's one vacuum and the scaling that appears there, I don't think there's any of this periodic structure. I don't think that actually happens. I don't see what those would be in the normal BKT transition. So as far as I know, no. Yeah, there's some formal thing where this sort of limit cycle behavior, this is called a limit cycle in RG. I'm not sure if there are any experimentally observed things like this. So this is some manifestation of the limit cycle in RG.
This is the generic feature of this critical point. This
BKT. I think so.
Or in some particular.
If I just did this calculation, I would say that I think so. Yes. I think something different happens in the real BKT transition that stops this, because it seems that Yeah, it seems this sort of oscillatory structure that it looks like it's actually oscillating in real space for us. But I think formally that's a consequence of the fact that you're annihilating two conformal points. So I actually think that this should be a consequence, yeah. But on the other hand, it doesn't happen in the classical BKT system. So I'm not really sure. But yeah, it's a good question.
Okay. A long time ago, we looked at brains and phase transition between brains, and we saw similar kind of behavior. Is there any connection?
Was it the same sort of instability? I think I'm not familiar with...
Well, maybe we can talk about it.
Okay, sure.
Another question, though, is you've got this spiral, and you're saying it's getting squished.
Yeah.
So, but there's sort of two scales there, sort of this width and that width.
Yeah.
Is there any meaning to those?
Let's think about it.
In particular, one of them is still finite.
Which width is still finite in the limit?
There's the maximum that...
This maximum, yeah. You're talking about, yeah. So eventually what happens is the spiral structure is replaced by something that matches onto the UV part. So sort of this thing is set by the UV scale, by where the ADS2 crosses over to the ADS4. So that remains finite in the transition, yeah. So yeah, the formula that we have is good in the vicinity of this point, basically, before the UV scale crossover happens. And from that point of view, you just sort of see it's squishing like this. This scale remains finite, yeah. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, okay. All right, good. Okay, so let me just summarize basically everything that we found. We found a non-trivial quantum phase transition from gravity, which has some strange properties, in that it's driven completely by the infrared physics. Okay? Any mutilation you do to the UV geometry will not change the fact that a condensed phase exists in this over here. So if you think about it, that is related to the fact that the susceptibility is finite approaching the transition. It's related to this crazy spiral and stuff like that. Because anything that's sort of careful and fine-tuned, like a vanishing susceptibility, okay, you could imagine removing by mutilating the UV physics in some way. Okay. But this sort of structure, there's nothing you can really do to it. The fact that it spirals around and around is a consequence of the fact that you break the BF bound. And there's really nothing you can do that will make this go away. You cannot remove these bound states. Okay? It's driven completely by the infrared physics.
Include that action in the case. Yeah. Just as the fatal of the geometry.
That's right. Yeah. So if you include that reaction, so we've done numerical calculations for the neutral scalar with the back reaction included, and we can't go all the way to zero temperature. Like we can't track this spiral down arbitrarily, but it seems to the numerics break down eventually, but it seems to match smoothly onto this spiral, and actually I expect that close to the critical point, all right, even if you include back reaction, what will happen is the nonlinearity part will be different, but the existence of this spiral is basically because you can match onto that ADS2 at a discrete number of levels. So provided you're close to the transition so that you get this oscillatory behavior in the ADS2, I think this spiral should actually survive, is what I think. But numerically, the back reaction, we can only do it numerically, and we've only done it in this one case. But in that case, it does seem to survive with back reaction. Sorry, what happens is, I think, that... So what happens is that you have an ADS2 region, you have an ADS4, and then you have some nonlinear region. So I think that the character of this nonlinear region depends on whether you include back reaction and all these things. But the fact is, close to the critical point, the scalar should be small by the time you get out from this nonlinear region. Okay? If that happens, then there will be a region where this ADS2 exists. Okay? The assumption that I'm making is that the scalar eventually becomes small. Okay, which you expect to happen as you approach the critical point. If that happens, then eventually it will be small by the time it gets here. And then it's oscillating in the ADS2 region, and basically that oscillation is enough to give the spiral structure. What I'm doing is I am pushing out where I do the matching to the ADS4, to the UV geometry. I can match it here, or I can match it here, or I can match it here, and that gives this tower of states. That makes sense? I think, I believe, as far as I understand, this is vaguely backed up by numerics, I believe that what happens in the nonlinear region is not actually important for this structure. Okay? Provided you're close to the critical point. If you go far from, if you move deeper into the condensed phase, then the scalar will start to get bigger and bigger, and eventually this region will be destroyed completely, because by the time the scalar comes out from here, it's still big. It's still backreacting. And then this will be gone. But there should be a region close to the critical point, Okay, arbitrary is close to the critical point where the structure does survive. So you're probably asking about deeper in. Yeah. The question is, I guess, whether this region really exists in all models if you include triscalar. So for the neutral scalar, it seems to exist. But we haven't studied anything in more detail than that. So yeah, again, the assumption I'm making is that the scalar is small when it gets here. So that should happen close to the critical point, I believe. Okay.
This scalar is neutral and it starts to backtrack to the black hole.
Yeah.
So it can increase in its mass in a sense.
Yes.
And therefore it's no longer extinct. If I get some temperature which increases.
I don't think that's quite right. There's still a ground if the scalar is neutral, okay, there will still be an ADS2 factor in the extreme infrared. For the same reason I said there was one earlier, because the electric field has to go somewhere. So it's still an ADS2 factor, and in some sense it's still extremal in that sense. So the condition of the scalar will not give it a temperature. I can still imagine cooling the system down. Maybe the right way to say it is, start from this, it'll condense, there'll be some temperature, now let me cool it down further. Okay? And the system I'm discussing, this vacuum, is the extremely cooled down version of that. So always the zero temperature solution. And since the scalar is condensing, really it means that there's a lower energy state, basically. Okay, so shall we talk about this after perhaps? Yeah. Okay, good. This is driven completely by the infrared physics, and the susceptibility remains finite approaching the transition. Now, the finite frequency critical response over here does not care about momentum. Okay, so this is kind of unique. And in some sense, this is a z equals infinity fixed point. Okay, by z equals infinity, I mean this z in normal dynamical critical phenomena tells you how the momentum scales relative to the energy. I'm telling you that over here, momentum plays absolutely no role at all. So it really does not scale at all. Okay, z equals infinity in some sense. And there's BKT scaling in time, but mean field scaling in space. So this is what we found. Now, here are some things that I hope to work on sometime soon. You could first of all ask how these critical degrees of freedom at the critical point affect other fields that they're coupled to. So for example, imagine putting fermions on this background. Okay, this is now similar to the holographic non-fermion liquids that were studied. And you could ask what happens to these fermions as you approach the critical point here. Okay, you need to do a one-loop calculation in the bulk to understand that. You basically take the fermion correlator and imagine coupling in scalars in some way. But we've developed a lot of technology for doing these one-loop calculations, and I don't think it would be too hard to actually do it. So it's something interesting, and I really have no idea what will happen in this case, because the sort of critical fluctuations here, like I said, are novel, and they're not of the sort that I know how to understand. Okay. So something that we could also do is try to write down an effective field theory for this sort of phase transition. Okay. So really, what is replacing the Landau theory in this construction? It should be possible to write down some sort of effective field theory alone that describes this. So many features of these holographic models can be recovered by a semi-holographic construction, which is studied in detail by these authors. In particular, these people talk about it at great length. And what you do there is, this you imagine having an action. This now is a field theory action, okay, not a bulk gravity action, that is split into an ultraviolet and an infrared part. The ultraviolet part is like a normal free field, say, like grad phi squared plus m squared phi squared. And the infrared part, on the other hand, is correlators of IR CFT that is just dual to this ADS2 region. So imagine that this is some planar sector, some planar theory, where correlators are determined by a conformal invariance. Now, then you couple these two together, okay? And now you calculate with this theory. So what do you find? Well, assuming this theory is planar in its large n limit or whatever, you can sum up all these diagrams, and the formulas that you get look basically a lot like the formulas that you actually derive from ADS CFT. Okay? In some sense, this is distilling the universal behavior of these holographic models. So this works very well for the non-Fermi liquids. And in a lot of other cases, it also works very well. But it's actually rather non-trivial to get this to work in our case. It doesn't seem to obviously work, basically because this sector is going so crazy in our case. And we're trying to make this work right now, Hong and Mark. They do, yeah, that's right. This depends only on frequency, basically, you assume. And this depends on space-time.
So yeah. That coupling is taking...
This integral is doing it correctly, yeah. So
it couples just to the average of the other...
It couples just to the average. So if you want to do it correctly, I think what you should do is you should, so really the IR dimension in most of these models, this delta, it depends on the momentum, okay, along that. So really you actually need to generate, you need to put one of these fields at every value of k to make this work correctly. But you usually just neglect that dependence, and in that case, this is just working with the average. Yeah. To get exactly the right answer, you need to have one of these at each value of k. Okay.
From this point of view, it's not surprising that you had such an analytical topic, like time and space. Are
yeah, yeah, that's right. The reason, I mean, even from the geometric point of view, it's not that surprising that you get this, because it does factor into an ADS2 times an R2. I guess what is surprising is that I hadn't actually expected, I knew that this happened, but I hadn't expected it to be so anisotropic. I had sort of thought that I expected some remnant of this R2 to remain in a more obvious way, to make it look more like an ordinary phase transition. So, okay. All right. So more speculatively, the field theoretical physics behind this thing remains completely obscure. Okay, I don't really understand field theoretically what's happening. So let me just speculate now what this is telling us. The fact that nothing depends on momentum sort of suggests that somehow different localized patches of this ADS2 are going critical by themselves. Okay? They don't really talk to each other. They're going critical individually, like a lattice of uncorrelated degrees of freedom that have nevertheless all been tuned to go critical at the same time. Okay? So what's kind of interesting is that a lattice of uncorrelated degrees of freedom is the sort of thing that you expect to have a non-trivial ground state entropy, entropy density. If any of them has an entropy, then there'll be a macroscopic entropy density. So this sort of makes sense from that point of view. And you expect these to be related. And indeed, in the gravity calculation, they are related. The reason why this happened was because the R2 stays at finite size, and the ADS2 shrinks to zero. And that R2 being at finite size is exactly the finite entropy density. So you really expect these two to be related in some way. And it would be really nice if we could try to make this precise somehow, maybe more field theoretically somehow, to understand what these degrees, well, maybe what they are is too much, but to understand the relation between this entropy density and this this instant sensitivity to k. Okay? And maybe this can even help us better understand the nature of this ADS2 ground state. Okay, that's all.
Yes. Charged by quotient instability of Hermitian rings.
Yeah, that's right. So in UV construct, if you actually do this from string theory correctly, then there's an instability to Hermitian rings. Yes, and run away. That is correct. So so this that's right. That's a fact.
And
yeah.
Temperature would destabilize some part of the background, which part?
Yeah, that's right. So so everything that we do with these ADS2s is basically just ignoring this fact that in actual string theory constructions, they're probably not stable. So the reason why we do this is basically because I guess we remain optimistic that there will be a way to create this ADS2 that does not have this instability. I can't say that this optimism is necessarily well-founded in things. Just that the physics that we're studying does not seem to be related to that instability in any way. And that's why we can sort of study it separately and not worry about this. But it's true that in known constructions, I think that this is probably not stable for a different reason.
Because it will study like a probe on the background of the larger anything that's create this background, and you know this issue that is not part of this probe. But the moment you start in fluid back reaction, you cannot really separate it.
I'm not sure I... So maybe what I'll say is that I'm just studying a gravity problem that has these propagating fields, and I'm just ignoring that. Because it seems that the physics that I'm studying is not related in any way to this. So I'm just studying a gravity problem, basically. I'm not really worrying at all about this, basically.
The big question is that this phenomenon will eventually happen in nature when there is no some large area in the world.
Yeah. So your question is whether this will happen. Okay, yeah, and I don't know, actually. I don't know. Yeah. So all these models that we study, the various, the UV constructions of them that actually involve, string theory, they're usually not stable at low temperatures. So we find the physics interesting enough that we're studying them anyway. But yeah. Okay, other questions?
I need to grab something and come back fast.